Now, there's a saying that you sometimes see written on a little plaque in a Christian home. Perhaps you've even got one yourself. It says, Christ is the head of this house, the unseen guest at every meal, the silent listener to every conversation. Anybody willing to admit that they've got that up on their wall somewhere, or I've seen it somewhere? Eric Hatz, anyone else? It's a nice thought, isn't it? Especially when we're thinking about Christian family life on a morning like this. But I wonder what difference it really makes. Not just to have a plaque on the wall that says it, but to actually believe and know that it's true, that Jesus really is there, in a sense, in your home. Do you suppose that it would make your household a wonderful, tension-free oasis of peace and serenity? Well, as we have already seen in this passage, having Jesus as your house guest does not mean the scope for family arguments is eliminated. Now, I must point out that while I did choose this passage for the occasion of Amelia's dedication, it is not because I think that the Griffiths are particularly prone to rows about housework. That's not why I chose it. But I do think that the lesson we learn here is relevant for parents aiming to bring up children who meet Jesus at home. In fact, I think here we find the essence of true peace and blessing in the long run for us all. Now, this well-known little Bible account is the nearest we get to seeing what difference it makes when Jesus is at home. This is the nearest we get to see him as an adult at home, isn't it? He didn't have a home of his own. He wasn't married. And he was, at this point anyway, rather alienated from his own family, because they completely failed to understand him, didn't they? In fact, last time we saw them with his family, they were trying to have him sectioned and taken away to the funny farm. And this tends to discourage you from popping home to see Mum, doesn't it? The thought that she might have you locked up. Jesus lived a life that was from pillar to post, one day here, another place there, and being human like all of us, that can't have been an easy experience. But he did have friends. Not just the bunch who followed him around, his colleagues, but also friends. And we learn from John's Gospel that Martha and Mary and their brother Lazarus were good friends of Jesus Christ. This little incident in Luke's Gospel was not a one-off visit. In fact, we can well imagine that their home in Bethany became the nearest thing that he had to a home of his own in this world, a place to rest and relax, and to join in the odd family row as well. In fact, Martha might even say that he caused the row, though Mary would say that she caused the row, and Lazarus, if he was wise, would keep out of it altogether. Now, I think we can look at this story at three levels, because we can find three sort of tensions that we need to work out. Three tensions that could arise even when Jesus is around, and sometimes especially when he is around. Now, at the top level, the surface level, we find the tension between different personalities, don't we? And we know what it's like because we too live in a world full of Marys and Marthas. And you probably live in a house full of Marys and Marthas too. The difference between them is obvious, isn't it, between these two women? Martha is the busy, active, stressed-out type. She feels the burden of responsibility. She wants to get on with the job and finish it before she can relax. Mary, we sense, is a bit more carefree, contemplative, spontaneous. Some might even say she was inclined to be a bit irresponsible and careless of others. A nice lass, but keep her away from your nard, won't you? John chapter 12. And we know plenty of Marthas and Marys and everybody else in between, don't we? And we all know that this means that sometimes those different personality types rub up the wrong way against one another. Now, what do we make of this? The answer is, well, it's great. It's fantastic. It's wonderful. Not that we have rows. That's not good. Of course not. We do our best to avoid that. But the wonderful thing is that God has made people different and put them together in even more sets of unique combinations in families and in societies and in businesses and in churches and in cities and everywhere else. Basically, although it causes problems, that is a wonderful thing, not a problem. And the message of this story is not that Mary types are better than Martha types. That is not the message of the story. It's just that in this particular situation, Mary chose the right priority. But the world needs its Martha type and its Mary type. God's family needs both types and every type in between. There's a place for all types of people in God's family. So maybe you imagine that you're not really the sort of person who could ever be a Christian. I'm not the sort of person because I'm not the religious type who can think about spiritual things. I'm too down to earth, here and now. Or maybe you think, oh, I'm not the sort of serious-minded type of person who can take faith and religion seriously. I'm too flighty and uncommitted to be a Christian. Or whatever. You're thinking, I'm the wrong type, the wrong sort. I could never become the kind of person who is a Christian, even if I wanted to. Don't you believe it? The Lord is not interested in turning Martha into Mary, or Mary into Martha. He is interested in turning busy but stressed out Martha into busy but happy and content Martha. He is interested in turning laid back but prone to be careless Mary into laid back but actually very caring Mary. You see what I mean? He doesn't want to turn you or me or anyone else into somebody else, but into a redeemed version of yourself, or that you personally are meant to be as you are. A huge amount of our own personal spiritual life and growth, our overcoming of sins and becoming a better person, is about learning to understand and work with and sanctify our basic temperament and character. And the same goes with our family too, doesn't it? A huge part of successful parenting is learning to respect and encourage the individual characters of your children as they are, rather than as you might imagine them to be. And that's the challenge and the joy of being parents. Jason and Katrina want to bring Amelia up to be Amelia, not the person they want her or imagine her to be. Maybe little models of themselves, perhaps, or models of somebody else. But that's not their goal, is it? And look at it another way. Suppose Jason and Katrina decide in the future that they'd like another child. Supposing it becomes possible and legal, can you ever imagine that at some point or other they'll say to each other, "Ooh, Amelia's lovely, isn't she? And we could do with another child, so let's take her down to the laboratory and clone her, so we can have another exactly the same." Don't know if Thomas Hazel can do that for you yet. But even if he could, you wouldn't want that, would you? Even if she's the best child in the world, you wouldn't clone her. You see what I mean? Successful parenting, success in parenting, and in fact in any family, like a church or anything else, means recognizing and valuing and working with the human differences that are there. Not to justify the genuine sins of each person, but to understand why things are the way they are, and make the most of each person as the Lord wants them to be when Jesus changes their heart. And yet those differences between people, they can lead to tensions, can't they? Maybe you have tensions in your home. Maybe we think that tensions in our home, or even our church, well, they are in danger of invalidating us spiritually. Maybe you're thinking, well, Jesus is not going to want to be an invisible guest at our meal table with all the rows that go on there. Well, do you suppose that Jesus was shocked that Mary and Martha should have a tiff in his presence? Do you suppose he'd never encountered anything like this before or again? Do you suppose that he was horrified, horror of horrors, that Martha should even have a bit of a go at him? Because she does, doesn't she? Lord, why don't you care? Don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work by myself? Tell her to help me. Martha's having a go at Jesus too, as well as Mary, isn't she? Does the Son of God faint if people do that? Do you imagine that this is the first time he had ever sensed the potential for any tension between them? And he was thinking to himself, oh no, never coming here again. Do you suppose that Jesus could not have found some nice little guest house down the road in Bethany, run by a professional landlady who didn't say a thing to him as long as he was back by 9? Do you really think that he was thinking, oh, I'm going to Bethany again, I'm going to have to stay with Martha, there's nowhere else I can go, oh, dreadful. All that rowing and arguing. No, of course not. The evidence is that if there was one place in the world where he wanted to be, one home where he preferred to stay out of all the others, it was this one. When he was in the week before he was crucified, where did he stay the night? In Bethany. Where do you suppose he was in Bethany? I don't think it's reading between the lines to think that he was staying here. This is the home where he wanted to be here on planet Earth. Yes, the home where clashing personalities bickered and argued and even tried to get him involved in their petty arguments. But a home where they loved each other and they loved him. That's why he wanted to be there. So we're not here in the business of justifying our actual sins, are we? Or saying that rows are a good thing. But differences are a good thing. And if tensions are sometimes part of that package in a fallen world, well, so be it. Worth it for the values that there is in a difference. And just because there are tensions doesn't mean that Jesus isn't there in your home. In fact, did you notice in Martha's house, the tensions did arise because Jesus was there. And sometimes spiritual issues are the things that raise the tension between different people. So don't go thinking that you or anyone else is not the kind of person that the Lord wants to know. And don't go thinking that your home or your family is not the kind of place where he would ever want to stay. You've got plenty to think about dealing with your real sins before God. So please don't waste your time condemning yourself for your mere differences too. Those are good things in the eyes of the Lord, as long as we learn how to deal with them. But let's move on, because I suspect that kind of thing you know already, don't you? I hope so. The second tension, at a deeper level down, is one of priorities. We see here the classic example of urgent practical pressures conflicting with important spiritual priorities, don't we? She had a sister called Mary who sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he said, but Martha was distracted by all preparations that had to be made. Now I guess all of us who've got any inclination at all towards spirituality feel this tension, either within ourselves or see it between us and other people, one way or another. There are urgent practical tasks, but there are also important spiritual priorities, and both are making a claim on our time and effort. In fact, I wish I could honestly say that it was always urgent practical tasks that kept me from spending time with Jesus. If only that was true. For me, it's just as likely to be something like cutting my toenails or making yet another cup of coffee or finding a pen to write my prayers down in my prayer book or just 5 minutes more in bed or I just wonder how this program's going to end or something like that. And much of the time it's the trivial things, it's the serious things that distract us, isn't it? If only I could really claim that I was genuinely too busy with urgent tasks that had to be done, that I couldn't give any time for spiritual matters. Can I honestly claim that? Can you honestly claim that? I think so. I don't believe it of 99% of other people. Martin Lloyd-Jones apparently used to say that nobody has got any real excuse to not to pray, except for mums with small children. And I agree 100%, except for the bit about mums with small children. Because actually, all you have to do is agree with your friend down the road, or your friend in the church, that you're going to get together on Thursday morning, and for half an hour, one of you will mind both children while you pray, and then vice versa. And then you have a nice cup of tea and chat for an hour afterwards. I mean, you can do it. You can do it. Now, let's be real. Planet Earth, this world that we live in, it's got very strong gravity, hasn't it? It pulls us down very firmly into its concerns rather than heaven's concerns. And actually, that is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. It's what we must expect. It's normality. Human beings are not meant to spend most of our lives in prayer and reading our Bibles. That's not actually what we're meant to do with most of our time. On 6 days you shall labour, on the seventh day you shall rest. That's a proportion, isn't it? There is work to do here in this world where God has put it, and he wants us to get it done. If Martha never did any cooking and spent all her time sitting at his feet listening to his words, Jesus would have found somewhere else to stay, wouldn't he? Because he liked his supper, and that was one of the reasons why he went to their house. Most of our energies and time and effort as human beings will be spent in our work, our studies, our homes, our families, our businesses, or whatever. And that is the way our lives are meant to be as human beings. So I don't think I'm saying here that practical things aren't important. They are. But spiritual priorities must find their place. They must find their time. If Jesus is a guest in our home, there's got to be a point where we stop the busyness. Even if the floor isn't spotless and the ironing isn't done and you haven't done the Yorkshire pudding. And listen to him for a change. And this must apply to us in our families and our children and so on, as well as it does to individuals. When do we all stop together and give spiritual concerns their right priority? And it's up to us parents, in fact, I'd say up to us dads, to make it happen. We model it to our children. Because it's what we want to do ourselves. Now in her life ahead, Amelia is not going to be short of homework to do and deadlines to meet and shopping to buy and lists to write and things to clean and people to see and nappies to change and Christmases to be ready for, not to mention friends to play with and fun to have and holidays to enjoy and everything else that will fill her life from every waking moment. She's not going to be short of those things. So now, while she is little, is the chance to demonstrate in practice that though those things matter, they are not what life is for, what life is about. Those things need to be done, but they're not what are going to save this world from all its problems. There is something more important. There is spiritual priorities. And they may seem less urgent, but are actually far more important than everything else put together. If you really believe Jesus is the guest at every meal and the listener at every conversation in your house, then prove it. Make sure there is an occasion every day when you shut up, sit down, and listen. So families, the practical question is, do we have some kind of devotional time or discipline together as a family, which involves some scripture reading and some prayer, and talking about what's going on, and all of that kind of thing? It can follow any number of different patterns, of course. But I worry, I mean, that used to be, as I understand, normal in Christian families. And now, to be honest, I worry that it's weird and strange if people are doing that regularly. Now, you don't have to tell me how difficult it is. If anybody wants to borrow Jonathan and find out how hard it is, then you're welcome to. It's hard for the little ones because they squirm, and it's hard for the older ones because they resist and they've got homework to do and friends to go and see and all that kind of thing. And it means for us parents a little bit of work because we have to set aside the time for ourselves, not just to do it but also to think about what we're going to do in a way that makes it interesting and to be a bit creative and all of that sort of thing. And it's hard and sometimes it doesn't work, it doesn't happen. But do we even try? Certainly with young children, at an age when they still have a bedtime story, there is no excuse for them not to have a regular little Bible reading
and a prayer at bedtime, at very least. And of course, more than that would be better, wouldn't it? Because at bedtime they're tired and not concentrating and so on. But it's a start. And if you need to use chocolate buttons to help it happen, use them. But it's not just about setting aside the time, as if that's what gets us to heaven. It's really about the whole attitude to life that that represents, isn't it? The biggest challenge Amelia and our children face in their lives is not academic progress. Will they make the grades? It's not marriage prospects. Will they find the right husband or wife? It's not financial security or health and well-being or their work-home balance, all these other things that we worry about. Those are not the most important challenges our children will face. The big problem they've got is that by nature, like every single one of us, they don't know God, the God who made them, the God who their sins will cut them off from, unless they meet God through Jesus. That's the big problem. And paint the bigger picture, the world around us. The biggest challenge our world faces today, it's not global warming. It's not poverty. It's not AIDS. It's not terrorism. It's not the decline of society. Whatever these things are that you worry about, bad as they are, the big problem is that this world does not know the God who made it and stands under his judgment rather than his love. And they will not meet that God until judgment day, unless they first of all meet him through Jesus and get to know who he actually is. That's what really matters. The spiritual things may not feel urgent, but they are important, more important than anything else. We must send at least our own children that message, mustn't we? That what life matters, what matters most in life are their spiritual concerns, to know and love God. And if we're going to send that message, we have to live that message. And if we can't live that message out in the world, we can't live that message out in the world around us if we don't first live it at a home, can we? And the wonderful thing about giving spiritual priorities their right place is it then turns the practical tasks into spiritual things as well. So in the end, there isn't actually a distinction between them at all, because the whole lot is sacred and offered to God through Jesus, if we put him there first, in the first place. So we've seen the surface tension between different personalities, but actually those differences are only superficially problems. In fact, personal differences are a good thing, and the Lord loves them, and we must learn to work with them, not against them. We've seen that at a deeper level, the tension between urgent practical pressures and important spiritual priorities. And these two often clash, don't they? And we've got to sort them out. We should give spiritual concerns their proper place in our lives and homes. And then if we do the other thing, if we do that, the other things tend to find their right place. But there's one more level in this story, even deeper than personal personalities and priorities. And that's the level of deepest principle. Because the most important thing is not whether we're stressed out or laid back types. And it's not even about whether you do your quiet time now or finish your ironing first. The choice we see enacted out between Mary and Martha is this. Is your life fundamentally, at its very basic, fundamental level, is your life about serving Jesus, or is it about having him serve you? That's the deepest priority, the thing that matters most. When Jesus came to thee, the most important thing on Martha's mind at the time was to serve him. She wanted to do her best for him. She loved him. She respected him. It was a great honor that he stayed with her. He could really use the rest. It was helping his work and his ministry. She wanted to serve him. Don't you want to serve Jesus too? I do. Don't you want Amelia to grow up to serve Jesus? I mean, I know I want my children to do that. But look what Jesus himself says about it. Martha, Martha, the Lord answered, you are worried and upset about many things, but only one thing is needed. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken from her. And we see here at the deepest level something more important even than serving the Lord. That is, to actually be served by him. Actually, only one thing is needed to do. Far better than anything you can do to serve Jesus is let him serve you. the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. This little journey through Bethany was in fact one step on a journey which Luke's Gospel begins, chapter 9, verse 51. When the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem, where he was going to be crucified. Jesus was already on the way to the cross. He was about to take on his shoulders the sins of all his people. So that meant Martha, with her stress and her temper, and Mary with her slightly careless ways. On the cross, he was going to take the blame for everything, from the deeper sins that beset their lives from the very beginning to this petty row that very morning. He was going to take it all upon his shoulders and bear the punishment of God. And that was the whole point of why he came into this world. Not for what we can do to him, for him, but for what he was going to do for us. And so the greater, better thing that Mary chose was to let him serve her, in this case, teach her, later die for her, before she could ever even think about serving him. And that is actually all we need. Whatever our personality is like, Martha or Mary or whatever, we all need forgiveness for our sins. And that comes from accepting that Jesus has paid the penalty for us, and that there's no other way to solve the problem. And until we really believe that he's done that for us, there's nothing we can do for him. All we can do is get that bit more worried and stressed out and upset trying. And this is the deepest tension we might find in ourselves, indeed in our families. It's the one that we must understand, the principle of grace. It comes from God to us, always in that direction. Begins and ends with him and what he does for us through Jesus. So if you're not a Christian, or you're in that situation where you don't quite know what that really means just yet, do you imagine that to be a confident Christian, you have to offer God something useful? That you've got to try hard to be good, serve him, and make your spiritual life work in order to get him on side in some way or other and prove that you're worthy of being a Christian? Do you find yourself thinking, oh, I could never be a Christian because I've just got nothing to offer God? Not like those wonderful, lovely people I see at church. Think again, won't you? All you need to have is the willingness to let him serve you. The humble, empty heart that will let God fill it with his love. In fact, if you haven't got that desire, that desire to be served, then actually your desire to serve him can be more of a hindrance than a help. It gets in the way of what really matters. To be ready to admit that you're a sinner with nothing to offer and need to be forgiven by his grace. That's what counts. And everything else, all that serving Jesus stuff, it follows quite naturally almost, but grace comes first. So all you out there who are trying so hard to serve him and get it right, please stop. And just let him serve you and get it right for you. If you are a Christian, don't forget that grace with which you began. If you're a parent, doing your best to bring up children with Jesus in your home, never let serving him overtake him serving you. So make sure that the kind of love you give to your children is unconditional love. You want them to work hard, to do well, to be good people, to pass their exams, to become Christians, to marry nice people, to win the FA Cup and save the world from all its woes. Of course. But make sure that they know you love them first. And that you love them in a way that doesn't depend on anything that they do. That you love them in such a way that they can't undo any aspect of your love if they fail you. And that you love them in such a way that they can't increase any aspect of your love if they excel. Make sure your love for your children is the absolute baseline, the unshakable foundation on which everything is set, be it their successes or their failures. Nothing changes that foundation for your children. And then make sure you're applying that same grace to yourself as well as to them. Eh? When you realize your failures to be a parent or a Christian or a housewife or that fun dad that you imagined you were going to be but now you're all grumpy and recognize him anywhere, be a parent by grace, not by works. Apply to yourself the same grace that you want to apply to your children, because you know that's the grace that the Lord applies to you. And then, if you're past the years of having children, if that's what you're up to, make sure that you remember it all of your life. Because grace matters just as much at the end of your life, when you're 82, as it does when you're 2. Because, you know, I've met a great many senior Christians who have faithfully served the Lord all their lives. They have martyred away year after year after year. But then as they get older, they find they cannot serve him in quite the way they did before. Or indeed, serve the church and the community around them. Time takes its toll, doesn't it? And I've found that some Christians, not all, but some Christians who have worked very hard and served all their lives when they were young and vigorous, find this challenge of not serving in that way anymore the biggest challenge of their whole life, and one they were never expecting. To discover that no longer can they serve other people so much as they now have to be served by other people looking after them. Many Christians struggle with that. And the question comes up, doesn't it? How much of my faith has been about what he has done for me? And how much depends on what I have done for him? We may only find out that when the strength to serve is taken away. And that's what the Lord says, isn't it? What Mary had chosen, in verse 42, will not be taken away from her. Implication, what Martha was doing was something that one day she would not be able to do anymore. Far better than rediscovering grace the hard way in the end is to never forget it in the first place. Eh? Make sure Jesus really is welcome in your home and your life because of the way in which he serves you as much as how you serve him. Make sure he's the guest at every meal and the listener at every conversation. You will be surprised at just what he can cope with. Those different clashing personalities, even those dodgy priorities. He can cope with all of that if he sees in your life that deepest principle of all. Grace and faith and trust in him. If you want to serve Jesus, then before anything else, let him serve.